Good evening, everybody. This is The Refinery, episode 22 on November 11th, Veterans Day 2014. And I want to say a thank you to the veterans in my life, both historically and current, and the veterans in all of our lives. I think I heard a statistic this morning. There's something like 9 million veterans in America right now. And I would say thanks to all of you individually, but the show's not that long. So thank you on behalf of everybody for writing a blank check to the country. I mean, that's...
On behalf of veterans, I'll just say you're welcome.
I can't even conceive of that. It's just really an amazing thing to do. Anyway, this is The Refinery, where we have three grassroots conservative organizations. Okay, we're not all conservative. We're kind of like conservo-libertarian-ish, mostly rhinos. Three grassroots organizations come together to discuss conservative messaging and how we can get better ourselves and help everybody else talk about things in a more better way, speaking English-ish better. And now I can see everybody on their cameras. They're all laughing at me. Thank God they're muted. Anyway, I'm Leslie. I'm with the Conservative Union, and there's a couple of us on here from the Conservative Union. We've also got Free Radical Network with a few people, and we've got the Party of Choice. And we will introduce ourselves when we speak for the first time so you can get used to all of our lovely voices. First off, okay, last week was like the major celebration episode where we had a big old party because of the massive victory. But I want to temper those celebrations a little bit because, guys, we're not finished. There is one election still to go in Louisiana that we've got a runoff that's going to happen in about a month, a few weeks, and that'll be Mary Landrieu versus Cassidy, because Cassidy won versus Maness there. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a tight race because Mary Landrieu's been the Democrat senator from Louisiana for many years. She's the daughter of a former governor, and they've got a whole legacy thing going on there. And in fact, Mary Landrieu gave a really, I mean, just a killer press conference earlier this week. She and about, I don't know, nearly 10 people were gathered in front of a microphone in front of a building with some signs that they had printed. Where was Bill? And she was talking about basically slamming Bill Cassidy for not really being around or being responsible or responsive to the needs of Louisianans during Katrina. She was touting her own efforts on behalf of people from New Orleans after Katrina. So, you know, where was Bill? The signs were all printed up. Where was Bill? They had obviously thought about this and knew that Bill was nowhere to be found. Well, sure. He was actually, let me read his tweet. Mary Landrieu wants to know where I was during Hurricane Katrina. He was setting up a surge hospital for refugees. So,
loser, loser, we have a loser.
Question.
We're out for loser, Landrieu.
I have a question. Did the campaign manager for Wendy Davis just go across the Texas border to Louisiana? Curious there, because it's like the same tactics.
At this rate, they're going to find a picture of him, you know, rescuing a puppy from the rising waters or something.
Yeah, exactly, and we'll put it right by her signs. Where was Bill? Well, Bill was saving a puppy.
No, she will put it out that he tried to drown a puppy.
Oh, okay, yeah, she would. Bill Cassidy hates puppies. Yeah, I was rescuing the puppy, Mary, but whatever. Whatever. And then we see the story that the Democratic Senate committee is pulling their advertising from Louisiana, and then when that hit the news, then the Democrats come back and say, no, that's not it. It's that, we were anticipating that the ads would be way more expensive, so we had allocated a lot of money to these really expensive ads, but turns out they're going to be a lot cheaper. So, yeah, that's why we reduced the budget of money we're spending in Louisiana. Okay, sure. And that at the same time that we're seeing stories that Reince Priebus and the GOP are putting together a unity rally, bringing together Tea Party groups, you know, the libertarian Rand Paul side of things, the Tea Party Ted Cruz side of things, and the more establishment side of things with Bobby Jindal and all of them coming together in a big rally to bring all of the Democrats together. And Bob and Maness very quickly after losing to Cassidy in the election last Tuesday, Maness has very quickly come in and said, I am fully behind Cassidy. I want all of my voters to support Cassidy. So the GOP is doing all of this unity stuff to just kick his butt, kick her butt. So that ought to be pretty fun. And
to be fair, she does look like a man.
She does. I got confused.
But not that war on women. We just got over the war on women. You're dragging it back into... This is it. Media Matters. We're sunk.
Yep.
It's done.
Yep.
How can it be war on women if she looks like a man? I'm just asking.
Oh, God.
It's a war on man, like on manly-looking women. Wait.
We're digging that hole. We're digging that hole. It's just terrible. Okay.
To change subject, sort of, although, you know, not completely, talking about the GOP's intelligent tactic about this, you know, taking the advantage of the one-month election and the opportunity to still, perpetuate the happy feelings from the success of the election, and the things that Reince is doing as far as keeping money flowing into the Louisiana election and highlighting the potential POTUS candidates and doing these things right, it really does help me to see that there's some stuff that the GOP appears to be doing behind the scenes that's actually good stuff, which is really surprising. And then we add to that this really lengthy article that was it in the Washington Times? Washington Post? Where was that article?
Washington Post.
That most of us on this call read about how the GOP won this thing. And I think Fishy, we wanted to start you out talking about this article because it really was an eye-opener for me, all these things the GOP's doing.
It was, and it was very interesting. If JD can put it in chat for people so they can catch up. One of the things that we really suffered from in 2012 during the Senate races was a comedy of errors, I suppose, with candidates that weren't strong enough. We saw it in 2010. We saw it in 2012. They weren't strong enough, or they weren't supported enough, or it was a bad mix, what kind of candidate they were compared to the kind of candidate needed to beat Democrats in particular places. And I think the GOP was learning from this. Although we didn't see proof of it, we do now. One of the things they talked about, and I don't know that Pat Roberts was anybody's favorite senator at all, but Pat Roberts has been in the Senate for quite a while, and Roberts has had a very close-knit, closed group of advisors and campaign managers and things like that. And what we find out in this article, right at the beginning, is that McConnell got involved in that race, and what he did, among other things, with Republican help and support from the National Senator Republican senatorial campaign, those guys made Roberts shape up his campaign. They got rid of the habit that people had of sort of insulating and making Roberts go rest and not really doing a lot and keeping a light schedule. They sent him all over the place, and they forced him to eliminate his lazy campaign manager, who was an old friend who'd been in there, a lot of times, but had no idea what we were facing now. Another really great anecdote, and I'm attempting to find it in this article. It seems that they called in these what is it, the different candidates from all across the country to come in and have a sort of a confab. You know, let's talk about how we're going to run a campaign, how you're going to handle different issues, what you need to know to be on the same page. And here's what it says. Minutes after landing at Reagan National Airport one day, early this year, many GOP Senate hopefuls found themselves besieged at baggage claim by people with cameras yelling questions at them about abortion and rape. Take that in for a second. This was no impromptu press news conference, but rather Republican staffers in disguise trying to shock the candidates into realizing the intensity of what lay before them. If that isn't a move in the right direction, I don't know what is. I was so excited to see that.
I mean, speaking as a person who, you know, has railed against the ridiculousness of dealing with a Todd Akin and having that kind of a situation on our hands, this is amazing news. This is outstanding. This is huge. It's completely different from the sort of, I don't know, slow, let everything wash over you situation that we had with the Republicans before, where, you know, we didn't do media training. Media training is words that were not in our dictionary, and you know, if they were, they weren't anywhere near each other. But this is, I mean, that's huge to have those guys realize that, hey, they are under attack by the media, so you better get used to defending yourself.
You know what this was? This was like training our military to go do special ops in the Middle East, because you're not just fighting against the enemy. A lot of the local, any of the locals can be dangerous. The bombs can be anywhere. The shots can come from anywhere. And they're training them to be on their toes. In other words, we're finally starting to show them. And as an ex-liberal, I can tell you, my name, Andy Pate, Party of Choice, sorry. As an ex-liberal, I can tell you, it makes me so happy that the Republicans are finally starting to see just what they are up against. They are up against people with no conscience, no lines, no restrictions within what they will do, no heart, no soul. These people will do anything to destroy them, and they finally get it.
Corey was talking about Buck. Corey maybe wants to jump in and talk about what the GOP did with Buck in Colorado.
I'm not remembering. Sorry.
No, remember that Buck had stepped out.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, well, Ken Buck was originally going to run for the U.S. Senate seat against Udall. And he gave it some thought, and he contacted Cory Gardner and asked Cory if he would consider running for the position, because he felt that Cory had a better chance of winning than he did. And then it created a bit of an uprising here and a bit of a stir among the other U.S. Senate candidates. But one by one, they decided to set aside their own agenda and to back Cory as the candidate who was most likely to win, and look what happened.
Yeah, and Ken Buck, who would not have done well statewide because he's very hardcore Tea Party, great guy. It's just
wonderful.
It's a blue-purple state, you know. So he got to stay in a very protected region, one of the most protected in the state, so he'd win for sure. And then we had the better candidate statewide. What a wonderful example.
This is what the article says about that. Democrats wrote the playbook for Ken Buck and failed to adjust when it wasn't Ken Buck anymore.
Their attacks on Cory Gardner would have worked with Ken Buck. Ken Buck had come out with solid statements in favor of, if you're raped, we're not going to let you have an abortion. I mean, he came out with solid statements in favor of that position. Cory Gardner never did. Cory Gardner was part of a legislation that you can stretch to use that way, maybe. And he even backed down to the position later. But you're right. their war on women thing that they played against Cory Gardner the entire time was designed for Ken Buck. And it didn't work.
And that's huge. I mean, that information, you know, just as it is pretty big. The fact that the Democrats did have a playbook for a specific candidate and the switching of one candidate to the next actually caused them to, you know, be confused, to have some just not being comfortable with the situation anymore, not having anything lined up. I mean, they didn't adjust. For whatever reason, they didn't adjust to the new situation. They didn't adjust to the new candidate. So, I mean, not that I'm suggesting that we try and switch candidates in and out, but the fact is that if we have somebody in, you know, a purplish state that's been there for a while, it might just be time to say, hey, pretend like you're running for a bit, and then we'll switch out and have a better candidate. We'll see if we can get some races more solidly in our favor like that. That was huge.
Well, actually, the Democrats do that, so why not?
Yeah, take that page out of their playbook and use it in ours.
Well, and it is to an extent that we're maturing as political operatives, as candidates, and as an electorate, you know, as voters as well. And we're realizing that to take a page out of their playbook of incrementalism, we want to get to the Tea Party libertarian more, I don't know, devolution or the 10th Amendment world, where things are handled at the lowest possible level rather than so much federal control. We want to get there, and we see that as our end result, but we're starting to all realize it's okay if that takes a little time, and in fact we'll be more successful overall if we accept smaller steps. And if we accept that we can't get Ken Buck elected statewide in Colorado yet, we might be able to do that in 4, 6, 8 years. But we can't do it yet. So right now, we put forth Cory Gardner. And, we're not going to get a super conservative in the Northeast. So let's go with, we'll get some moderates there, and we'll have overall more GOP reps. And we'll move things to the right gradually. And that's a maturity of both the voters, the party, and the candidates as well. So I think we're getting there.
Another thing that I found interesting really quickly, just to throw this in and then throw it to Andy, apparently the RNC was hiring its young staffers and sending them all over the place with mobile apps ready to help build the party's database even more. And Americans for Prosperity spent $60 million or so on its own ground game, hiring, it says, 500 field staffers in pivotal races. That's cross-communication, the likes of which I don't think we're used to.
Yeah, overall, I think it was just a terrific step forward for the party. Now, they didn't bat 1,000, though. And one thing that I think they need to do going forward is they need to incorporate more of the Tea Party leadership in these decisions. A number of Tea Party leaders, you know, got on board and helped campaign, like in Kansas and so forth. But let me give you a good example. The Republican Governors Association pushed for Bob Beaupre, and they even put money in behind the scenes here in Colorado. At least that's the allegation. I guess it has not even been denied, to advance Bob Beaupre as our candidate. Bob Beaupre's a great guy, would have made a terrific governor, but he he wasn't the candidate you wanted here. We had a popular government in a moderate Democrat in a blue state. You have to come out swinging. You have to have somebody who can really draw distinctions, no pale pastels, like Reagan said, clear why we're different. Beaupre didn't do that, and you could see across the board, In a year when we had 117,000 more Republicans vote than Democrats in Colorado, he still lost by like 2.5%. Just the wrong choice. So it's not like they were perfect in what they did, but overall the strategy was much, much better. The only thing I would do going forward is I would incorporate a little more Tea Party leadership so they can get a little, you know, a little more well-rounded messaging.
Yeah, and I will say, just commenting on the Northeast, and nothing bad about Jeff Bell, because he's a great dude, and I was glad to, you know, for Radical Network and for Conservative Union and for the Party of Choice, come together and do an interview with him. He was a really great dude, but clearly the RNC was not participating the way that they did in these other races here in New Jersey. Clearly there was not that oversight that sort of get these guys together and figure out how to run a campaign going on here in New Jersey. So I guess maybe that's a good sign to an extent, because that means that they're focusing their resources on seats like the Colorado one and like Virginia and places like that. But it is kind of disheartening for me, because I'm from the Northeast and I really, really, really wish that we had some of that that kind of media savvy and interaction and sort of the push from the RNC in this area to even make an attempt to win the seat here. Maybe we'll get it in a few years when Bob Menendez is back up on the ballot, because nobody likes him anyway. So that'll be a good chance for us.
Well, and it's easy to pick on the Northeast, because you're sort of the bastard stepchild of Republicanism or conservatism. But, you know, truly a little bit of an investment in New Jersey can make for stronger Republicans at the lower levels that then build your farm team. And I too would have liked to have seen that, but, you know, Chris Christie was busy getting governors elected all across the country. And so, you know, good job, kudos to him for that. One of the other neato stories about this election was how well some of the statewide guys did in Texas among Hispanics. And they didn't do it by pandering on amnesty. On the issues, they were across the board really tough, securing the border, anti-illegal immigration, no abortion kind of guys. And many of those issues work really well with the Hispanics in Texas. There's an article in Human Events, and I'll put the link somewhere in a minute. I want to read this section even more so, and this is specifically talking about Greg Abbott, because he was pretty successful among Hispanics in Texas. He spent an awful lot of time in the border counties. But even more than his issue positions, the language that a candidate uses, the empathetic and welcoming approach they make, and the year-round effort to relate to the community can produce support for conservative Republican candidates. While issue positions and public policy stands are the reasons many conservatives are active, it is essential to remember that other factors can have a greater impact on many voters, regardless of race or ethnicity. And Greg Abbott did continually appeal to the Hispanic community beyond just the issues. He had issues that many of them can relate to, but he also had the Hispanic mother-in-law cutting advertisements for him about how proud she is to have him as a son-in-law and how proud she will be to have him as her governor. And those billboards were up all across the valley. And he's, you know, opening up field offices that he's had people in, you know, year round. So he's had Republican pro Greg Abbott presence year round, and that's a tactic that we see of Democrats, and we've in fact talked about it on previous episodes here, where Republicans need to go into these other communities and just be there, be the people that they know. And in this article in Human Events, they kind of mentioned that. People will vote for the folks that are like you, that empathize with you, that speak your language. And I don't mean technically Spanish versus English. I mean speak the language of issues that are important to you, the topics that matter, and the syntax that you use, because they're your friends. And that's how we see anti-abortion Catholics voting Democrat. because the Democrats are like them. The Democrats are with them. The Democrats are there in their communities. And we need to fight back and fight on those grounds. And it seems like there are some people here in Texas who have done a pretty who have learned that lesson and are at least beginning to improve the Republican ratings or the Republican performance in Hispanic communities. And that's a pretty good thing to see as well.
Leslie, I am so glad that you brought that up. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, we can hear you. By the way, just tell everybody who you are.
I'm Chandra Surface, and I work with Corey and Andy Pate with the Party of Choice. I'm very glad that Leslie brought that up about Texas and about those people who are in those Hispanic districts, because that was one of the stories that I was so happy to read about. He's not a fellow that we've heard about much in the national news, Will Hurd. Have you heard of him? He was the 37-year-old to win in the 23rd district down there in Texas. It is the largest district there, and it has like 800-some miles of border territory with Mexico. And Will Hurd is a Black American who is now going to Congress, and he was voted in by a majority of Hispanic people. And I love that. He is somebody that we need to look at carefully at how he ran his campaign, the things that he ran on, and follow his example, because I think he is a remarkable person. So that was my two cents. I was very impressed with some of the people who won in Texas.
I could have sworn that all conservatives were racist, so I don't see how... You must be wrong, we didn't elect the Black guy. In Texas, I mean, especially in Texas. So they couldn't have elected the Black guy for...
Hispanics no. voting for a Black man in border territory.
GOP. It just, you know...
Yes.
It breaks it all of
about,
the...
It wasn't about skin color. It was about a man who espoused conservative... principles, and in a strong way. He is somebody that we need to study. He's somebody that we need to emulate in future campaigns.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's a great thing. Fishy, I think we were talking about an article a while ago where maybe it was the governor's race there in Texas where 90... there were 90 staffers hired as opposed to 10 for the state for the governor's race. Is that what it was?
I'm not exactly sure the number, but they had a heavy concentration in the urban areas in terms of staffers that Abbott had employed, which was phenomenal. And I had actually talked to one of the coordinators at a recent event right before the election where there was they were responsible in the next county as a joint effort between our county, a candidate, and theirs to set up an office, a local office right around the corner from me. And one of the stories that she told me was that the staffers on the Abbott campaign had a quota to meet of voter contacts every day, and it was a really high number, and they would keep the people whose numbers were met every time, and they would let go the people who didn't perform in that area. And so this office, when they weren't making calls for a particular candidate or to talk to people about mail-in ballots for the older people that can do that in Texas, they were making calls with those staffers to help them keep their numbers up and make sure that they were all coordinating together for the Abbott campaign. It was beautiful.
That's huge. That, I mean, again, it really does seem like for the first time in a while, we haven't been outpaced by the Democrats when it comes to campaign strategy. And, I mean, that's great news. Obviously, we don't want to get into the gloatapalooza that we did last week, but there are serious strides that have been made in this past election. It wasn't the sort of emotional response type of election. It wasn't, oh, we have to do something because there's this big bill looming. It was a technical win. It was a win where we actually went out there and got things accomplished. We found that we targeted people, and we got their votes. That's a huge difference. It's a huge victory in my opinion.
I'm happy to know that many of our victories were not accidental. They were not by chance. They were due to efforts that can be and should be, and God is my witness, will be repeated. Because you want success to be something that can be repeated. Otherwise, it's just, you know, it's just luck. And I'm glad to know that this wasn't just luck. There was a lot of luck, and there was a lot of mistakes by the other side, which made our victories more substantial than just our tactics justified. But I'm really glad to see that there were some of these really positive tactics, and we can expand on that as things go.
Well, this is Peter from Free Radical Network. I think it's important to point out. Thank you. I think it's thank you very much for that free plug. It's also important to point out that in 2010, we had some good. Well, we swung the. And I'm going to step back even further to 2008. They stated in 2008 we were looking at 40 years of Democrat control in Congress, and in 2 years. They swung the House from Democratic control to Republican control. Then in 2012, we put up Mitt Romney, and it wasn't quite enough to get Obama out of power. But we still maintained the House, and then we had the Senate that we took this year while moving the majority in the House in a positive way for us. In 6 years, we went from having Democrat control for 40 years to a Republican full control of the entire Congress with the exception of the White House. In 2010, when we had the Tea Parties forming, there was a lot of learning that needed to happen. And I think it's very safe to say that a lot of lessons were learned, hard lessons, mind you, but they were learned. And the Tea Party has moved beyond just being an upstart party to being this group of people that is savvy, that is educated, that is knows what's going on, and they're learning from the mistakes that they've made and growing from it. So is there still a lot more to do? Certainly, but they're certainly a lot more mature than they ever were in the past, and that's a positive thing.
Yeah, I think that to a large extent that's true. And another thing is about the sort of coming together of the various branches and realizing that we have a common enemy that needs to be, you know, addressed, otherwise the country is in a bad place again. So the fact that, and we've talked about this a lot, is the fact that there's been a lot of coordination between the various planks of the conservative movement, of the Republican Party, coming together and behaving like a team, which is so important and so impressive that we finally seem to be able to get past our petty differences, our squabbles over, you know, oh, this issue is more important, no, that issue is more important. Those issues are all important, but the most important issue is making sure that we win, because we can't address any of those issues until we win, and we actually got to win this time. So that's hugely important. And speaking of unity, I think going from unity, we might want to shift over to the opposite of that. We're strong when we're united. We're strong when we have our team assembled, and when we have a very diverse panel here tonight on the Refiner. We have, you know, the libertarianish people, that we have the social conservatives, we have, you know, Christian right, Tea Party, all of those things. We have that here, and we function as a team. We work together, and regardless of our differences on the issues, we like each other, we tolerate each other, and we try and get stuff done. The left doesn't like that. The left just lost to that, so clearly they don't like that, and they want to break that up. And there are a lot of things that the left is doing to break our party up, to not only end our party, but to dissolve us, to make us into, or, you know, go back to our separate corners and hang out there. So I think that's a pretty good time to throw it to Andy, because Andy, you have a new article up on partyofchoice.com.
Yeah, the new article is called We're Becoming Them. We're Becoming Them. And it's talking about how we on the right are becoming way too much like those on the left. And first of all, let me just say one thing I love about The Refinery is that this is a revival. The Refinery is a revival. I became a Republican a couple decades ago. And when I came to the Republican Party, it was everything J.D. just described. There were people with who were more conservative, more moderate, more this, more that, and they worked together much more. They liked being under one tent so that they could always be challenged. It was a place of mutual challenge with individuals challenging one another and so forth. In recent years, especially in the last couple elections, we've been splintering off into isolated groups and comforting ourselves by just surrounding ourselves with like-minded people and shouting down others. And the article that I wrote, We're Becoming Them, gets into a very disturbing trend I've seen. And it was, I could totally predict when, after we won on Tuesday, well, we didn't win everywhere, right? We had some losses. I could totally predict that there were going to be very typical reactions everywhere, because it has now gotten to the point where both the Tea Party and the establishment have completely ready-made, because I do a lot of blogging, you know, Facebook, they have completely ready-made talking points no matter what the situation, okay? In every election, there are four different situations that can happen now, okay? You basically either have a Tea Party candidate who will win, or a Tea Party candidate who loses, or you have an establishment candidate who wins, an establishment candidate who loses. And in all four of those situations, both the establishment and the Tea Party will spin that to show we were right. No matter what happens, we were right. The establishment guy wins. Well, this proves that, you know, that establishment, that our kind of candidates are better because they reach better across the and the Tea Party says, no, you only won because we sucked it up and held our noses and voted. We were team players. Well, you reverse it, the Tea Party candidate wins, and they'll say, this proves that, you know, ours reaches better, you know, fewer pale pastels, draw a clear line. And the establishment says, no, you only won because, unlike you, we're not divisive and we turned out and voted. And they use the exact same lines, but they do it in reverse. Here's what got me. And it really struck me. See, I was raised by the left. And if you listen to the left, here's some things they say. I broke them into four quick groups. Number one, the spinners, the people who spin. Look at global warming. They'll say no matter what the weather or temperature, it proves global warming. No matter what the result, no matter what happens, we'll spin it and say this proves that global warming is true, which is exactly what we're doing. Then you've got the control freaks. And they'll say, we must manage the people so they will make our choices. Well, that's exactly what the GOP elite has done in a lot of cases. They've tried to control the party, control everything, and then they say, let's walk side by side and sell individual liberty to everybody. Okay, then you've got the victims on the left. The deck in life is always stacked against us. And let me tell you something. I hear that constantly, some from the establishment, mostly from the Tea Party. We are victimized. Everything's stacked against us. Well, if we win, it's despite the we had to overcome the establishment and this. We're never helped. It's boiled down into nonstop victimhood all the time. And the establishment does some too. And finally, the unyielding labelers. No matter how you criticize our president, you're a racist. You cannot criticize a Tea Party without being called a rhino. You cannot criticize the establishment without being some, you know, whack nut, wing nut extremist.
Wacko bird, I believe, is the term you're looking for.
We use wacko bird, yeah. Wing nut's another one. And they throw, what I've seen on the blogs and on Facebook and these things in recent years is all these completely, here's what I'm bringing in at home here, guys, all these completely left-wing talking, rhetoric, strategies done by right-wingers, all of them. We everything, no matter what happens, it shows I'm right, just like global warming. We have become, we're becoming them. And this disturbs me. It scares me. And it needs to stop.
Andy, where would you place those people that I've run into a great deal before the election on several different blogs who are what I call the one-issue purists, those people who, regardless of how voting a certain way will help move that needle in the right direction, those people, if you're not with them on that one issue, you know, I mean, they don't necessarily vote Libertarian. They don't necessarily vote Tea Party. It's just a one issue. Deal with them. Where do you put them? I'm wondering if that isn't another group that we need to figure out how to bring in.
Well, like you put it very well, they're everywhere. There are single issue voters of every kind. You'll have the Libertarian single issue voter who will not vote for anyone who would authorize a war. There are the intense pro-life. I've run into many pro-life voters, and I'm pro-life, but who, unless their candidate, you know, does Rick Santorum and says, you know, no abortions, even in cases of rape, you're a compromiser. What I tell all of them is the same thing. And I wrote an article just like, I think, three or four articles ago called Advancing Our Single Issues. And the main point was this. Suppose that, okay, you're saying that only if your single issue is advanced will you support the candidate. Okay, well, what if the next guy says, okay, but I'll only support them if they go as far as I want on gun rights. Well, okay, I agree with you, that's okay. But now the next person says, only if they are absolutely where I'm at on immigration. Then the next person says, on foreign policy. Then the next person says, on, you know, and you just go issue after issue, the corporate tax rate and whatever. Here's the key, and here's what I tell them, Chandra. Your strategy of my single issue or nothing only works if no one else uses it. So you've embraced a strategy. Hey, God love you. I think it's wonderful that you're willing to soak in all those flaming arrows of anger from our society at a time when most people are cowardly and hide. And I think it's wonderful you're so brave. But don't take on a strategy that only works if nobody else uses it. You're shrinking your audience. People aren't going to listen. You're not going to be effective. And you're asking too much of everybody else to say, everybody go my way, but I won't go any of yours.
Right.
I love that.
And sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just cheering him on. You go.
I was just going to say that I think that another thing to keep in mind when it comes to those, when you wind up in a situation where you see one of the single-issue voters, and I think we've discussed this before on the Refinery, is just that when you come across somebody who says, all right, I won't vote for this candidate who, you know, whatever, is not 100% on my train of thought for this election in my state, if you think that this is somebody who's willing to support, you know, is ready to support an actual politician outside of the state, that is the, I think that's the key way to go. It's very hard to take somebody who is going for a single issue and somehow turning them into a person who's ready to vote for the party in general. It's much easier to direct them at a race where they would like to participate. So that's a strategy that I've used, is if you come across a single issue voter, point them at a race where they can be effective and where they can be helpful because there's a candidate that they like there. Tell them to donate their money there and donate their time there. That way they aren't a waste of resources.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think they can also be somewhat a waste of our energy. I mean, I've met some who are just immovable.
Yeah, which is why it's much better to direct them towards something where they could be useful. So instead of wasting your time arguing the point of single issue, you know, their single issue needs to be the most important versus somebody else's, it's much easier to push them towards a race where they can actually ideologically, principled, whatever, go through all those buzzwords, support the candidate and actually get something good accomplished. So instead of dealing in the dirt with these guys and arguing back and forth, just push them towards a race where they can support a candidate, and then you've actually created value for the party.
Well, one thing that I emphasized in the article also is I'll tell the single issue voter, I want you to have the greatest chance to succeed with your issue. I want you to have a bigger audience, and I want you to have a better chance to advance it. If you tell people it's my way or the highway, then the only people who will listen to you from that point, from the moment you say it's my way or the highway, and this is my issue, from that moment forward, the only people who will listen to you are the choir, the converted, the ones who already agree with you on that issue. You see, I strongly, I cannot make more people pro-life by only talking to pro-life people. I need pro-choice people around me to talk to. Pro-choice Republicans draw them to me. A wider tent gives me a much wider audience, people I can talk to. And secondly, my single issue, and I actually have several, but abortion's a big one, my single issue will be advanced much more with a coalition, a team, a coalition, where now and then I support somebody who isn't with me, but generally I get my way. My single issue will advance far more that way than without a coalition, where I always lose because at that point I'm using a strategy that only works if nobody else uses it, which is a dying strategy. And I found at that point all but the real hard cases will come over, and even the hard cases I found at that point at least soften some to where they don't affect others nearly as much.
And that's good stuff. It's about on the single issue voters, and really with anybody that is actually on your side but kind of is trying to combat you, not just walking away, but guiding them, like JD says, guiding them towards someplace where their efforts can be helpful rather than focusing on the conflict, or finding that point of common ground where you can move forward together. And frankly, it's going to be a lot easier for us to work as a coalition of differing groups because it's a lot easier to gather together with people when you're successful. You know, when you're the fracturing that we saw of the conservatives and the GOP was because when you're a loser, you lose alone. And we all want to point at the other guy as being the cause of being the loss. So, I mean, I think it was natural that in our losses in 2008 and 2012, we were pointing at each other saying, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. But now that we've had some success, we can say kumbaya and all hold hands and be the establishment plus the Tea Party plus conservatives plus the social cons plus the neocons plus the crunchy cons plus everybody else, and we can all work together. And what's been really interesting is to see how quickly the left has realized that that's going to happen. So how quickly they have jumped on the issues that they can use against us and to tear us apart and have us combat each other. And I've even fallen into it myself in the last couple of days, arguing against people on my own side about an issue that we actually should agree on. One of the things that Obama is really going for is this net neutrality stuff. And make no mistake, it's because he wants more government control, because he always wants more government control. But a lot of it is because it's an issue that cuts across the conservative spectrum. It gets us fighting against each other. And it's something that, because it's technology and it's the internet, you can get a lot of people on the internet very worked up about it, because everyone really knows the really real truth, man, because I really know, because I'm really in this industry. And they will fight each other because I have the real facts and you don't, and you just don't understand. And you'll see our side fighting against ourselves and having arguments with people on our own side about whether net neutrality is a good thing or a bad thing. And we're falling into their trap. We're playing to their hand when we do this.
I want to bring up that it's a very complex issue. And it is a very complex issue because of the regulation of mass communication that we have in cable and television and all the other industries. And then here you have this one free, unregulated, free meaning unregulated, not free,
unregulated, right. Sort of, because cable companies are super regulated already.
Right. But you have this one means of communication that has less stringent regulation on it than the other means of communication, and that what the government is pushing for is regulation of it. In whatever form that takes, whatever way that looks like, it is a complex issue, and I've heard cases on both sides that sound completely reasonable. Mm-hmm. And it makes me nervous that this issue will be used against Republicans because it's so complex, and people who hear talking points and, you know, slogans will, and the title net neutrality, will just gravitate towards supporting an issue without knowing anything about it. We even had a floor fight in the middle of convention this summer for the Texas Republican Convention because of those two words in the platform. There are plenty of people in the room who had no idea what they were voting for or against. They just didn't know. That is an issue that is going to hobble us, but it's also not the only one. Think about Obamacare and what to do about Obamacare. That's divisive. Immigration is coming down the pike. We know the Democrats are going to concentrate on immigration because of how it tears at the unity of the GOP, or impeachment, or gay marriage.
Yes.
These are all things that are going to come up. We're calling it here today on the Refinery, November 11th, 2014. We are calling it. Those are the things that the administration and the Democrats, the ones that are left, are going had to. But those are the things that they're going to bring up in order to try to divide us. And I think we could probably find much better issues to move positively on while we learn more about how to deal with the other ones.
You know, it just occurred to me, we frequently talk about the Democrat echo chamber. Oh my gosh, it's empty now, so it's an even more echoey echo chamber. I just had like a little visual of, hello. Hello, Debbie, it's Harry. Are you out there anymore, Debbie? I'm thinking Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Harry Reid. They're all alone in the hall, in the echo chamber. Sorry. Back to your regularly scheduled conversation.
But we can see how those issues are going to be divisive and really rip at the unity that we've just got. It's a great thing that we have case now to point to where everybody can think and feel and believe and know that they contributed on the right to this victory. Everyone was doing something. Instead of worrying about tearing each other apart, we really did come together and work on these campaigns, these candidates, and attempt not to shoot ourselves in the foot this time around. But that victory is a fleeting, momentary thing, because you're always getting ready for the next fight, and the next fight is going to be huge. Whatever we do between now and 2016 is going to lay the groundwork for what our candidate has to deal with.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, to me, it makes me feel like a lot of these issues, we're in control now. We talked about this last week. We're the guys who get to drive the conversation. The fact that we have the House and the Senate means that we are in control. So to me, I don't see a good reason to approach net neutrality, you know, with a 40-foot pole. These are things that just get us in trouble. There are things that we can, that are more important to address, that we can address on favorable ground instead of going into this swampy territory where, oh, monopolies and of course, the Republicans are going to be for helping these big companies like Comcast, which is a liberal company, of course, Ted Cruz is taking telecom money, which is why he's against net neutrality. We go into these murky areas at our own risk, and it's not something that we need to do. It's not something that needs to be on the agenda this second. We have the pipeline that we need to deal with. We've got Obamacare.
We've got a continuing resolution or a budget that we need to do.
We need to have a budget. We've got wars going on all over the place. We've got a ton of stuff that we need to address, and none of them are less important than net neutrality. So
if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Most of the objectives of net neutrality are to prevent some big company from doing something that it hasn't even occurred to them to maybe even consider doing, but somebody thought they might, because there isn't a law against them doing it, that means that they could. So, oh my gosh, we better write 1,000 pages of legislation written by lobbyists and cronies to prevent them from doing this thing that they don't want to do. And one of the articles I read, and I've only read a couple and only skimmed because it bores me to tears. This has been one of Obama's top priorities since 2007. Okay, top priority for 7 years, and nothing has happened. Guys, we can ignore it for the next 2 years, okay?
It's like the Ark of the Covenant. Right. Yeah, top men. We've got our top men working.
Why do we, so Obama is saying this is his big agenda item. Didn't we just 1 week ago today decide nobody cares, Barack? We don't care.
We voted on that agenda. Sorry.
And yeah. We have our own thing that we're going on. So net neutrality, yeah, whatever. Talk to the hand.
I'm sorry. We have to vote on keeping Guantanamo Bay open first.
He will not sleep until...
I feel like this is Obama's attempt at a squirrel moment. In other words, this election was his second shellacking. I like the way I saw one writer put it, and I'm forgetting their name at the moment, but I'm sure Fishy read the article, so she'll correct me. But he said that it was his... Little Bighorn. This election was Obama's Little Bighorn, and I was like, that is fantastic. So,
okay, wait a minute.
Now,
there is no squirrel moment with this president.
No. He wants to seize the initiative because he has to. He lost, and he lost big. And if he doesn't jump on something and make it huge, in other words, manufacture a crisis, then he's going to be relegated to the backwater. And he cannot in any way, shape, or form handle that. The man loves attention. And if you take it from him, he gets pissed. So he's trying to pull people's attention away from what the GOP is saying by saying, squirrel, look over here.
Yes, but this is what the administration has done for 6 years. It's how they operate. This is what a campaign is about, not a governance. And so every time we've had a scandal, there's something else. Every time there's been one thing consuming the American public, oh, our website doesn't work. Crap, we'd better have something else hit. And then they throw out an attack in another direction. It has been the issue go round, and we've talked about that before. This is what they do. When things, you have the highest priority in the world of passing Obamacare, and you get that done, and then we're going to get this website, and it's going to be working. And then we're going to move to this issue. And that every issue is the most important issue at that moment, because that is the strategy, that is the tactic. There's no follow-through, there's no one thing I'm going to pass and get it done in my agenda. It's every time there's a disruption in the worship of Obama or the attention on Obama, there's a distraction. So this is nothing new. It just happens to fall right after the biggest freaking shellacking he's ever had.
You know, but we deserve this. We deserve to have this succeed against us because we make one huge mistake. We wait until the end to bring up the end of an election cycle to bring up the issues. We wait until the end to drive things home. And here's what I mean. We can say, well, what do you mean? We talk to each other. Yeah, we talk to each other on talk radio, on blogs, in our groups, at Tea Party groups, at Republican groups, and so forth. But look at what just surfaced, right? This big thing about the architect of Obamacare admitting full out, we had to lie to get it passed. And he said not once, not just that time, but was taped in another time saying it's because the American voters are stupid. They're too stupid we have to con them into believing this. Now, we're worrying about, well, he's going to use squirrel, net neutrality, squirrel this, squirrel that. We're sitting back and waiting while they move the pointer all over the place, all over the room, and everybody looks. They're holding the laser light. Pick it up. What I would do is this, and then we wait and we use all our money on ads only at election time. Why aren't we running ads right now saying, running the quote of this guy and very quick, brief language saying they admit this is his architect of this, of Obamacare, admits they had to lie to get it by you because you're too stupid, and then say, go to this website to learn more. Why aren't we doing that now? No, we're waiting for them to say squirrel.
I just put an article in the chat about Gruber himself and the guy who busted it, and I just want to note for the record that Dave Weigel, reporter that I had praised a few weeks ago, is the one who wrote the article in mainstream. It was in Bloomberg Politics.
But he's a liberal. How could that happen?
You know, the funny thing is, once again, we trained our candidates and did this right this time, right? We trained them to enter into warfare in an enemy country. Don't expect anyone to be on your side, right? But what are we doing now? We're expecting the media to, forget the conservative media, the only conservatives listen to it. We're expecting the media to honestly reveal what has just happened. We have the signature achievement of the entire Obama administration, the architect of it admitting that they had to lie to the American people and all this. This is monstrous. This is huge. This could absolutely derail anything the president wants to sell us, be it net neutrality or anything else. It could absolutely derail it if we get it out there in front of the public. But what are we doing? We're waiting for the natives, the media, to do this for us. We're not acting like we're in enemy territory. Act like you are. This is where you spend the money, right now.
Exactly.
Put this out there. Don't wait for them.
I agree with Andy here, and this is something that I was talking with Fishy about earlier today, is we have been on the defensive for so long that we've forgotten what it's like to go on the offense, and it's time for us to do that. It's time for us to push back and to push back hard. We have been playing prevent defense for far too long. It's time that we got the ball back, and instead of punting on first down, pick up the ball and start running it down the field. And we're not doing that. We're waiting to see what they're going to do. And I have a fundamental problem with that. And it's time that we did something, and we don't.
Well, as I just said in the chat, that is an easy enough task right there to put together a video with Gruber's quotes and then some framing around it and put it out there and nudge it toward the RNC, and maybe they can improve on it with some money and send it. You know, that sort of an ad somewhere. That's easy to do, to show them the way. That's how we can be proactive to force them to be proactive.
Do we, would we cut in clips of Obama claiming to be the most transparent administration ever, and then this guy saying that lack of transparency is the key to getting this thing passed, and then go to Obama saying that Obamacare is the key cornerstone of his administration, and, you know, just point, counterpoint, you know, step 1, 2, 3, 4, they lie to you, they know they lie to you, they're proud of how much they lie to you, and everything they say is a lie. If they say it's going to rain, you know it's going to be sunny.
Because and I think you're stupid.
You do two ads, and one is the 60 second, and one is the 30, and the 60 second includes the clips of Obama, you know, setting it up and going back and forth. The 30-second just uses brief clips of this guy with, you know, and you've got to have the wording at the bottom because people can't follow him a lot. And then just in big words with music, you know, with rock music, or basically because you're stupid, and at the end, because you're stupid, because you're, play that back again and again, to the beat, because they're too stupid, because they're so stupid, and hammer it home.
But, oh, right, like auto-tune the guy?
Basically, the first 20 seconds you'd spend showing, here's how they had to sell, they can only get them to buy it if we lied, so they had to lie. And by the way, you got to throw in, they lied about the big lie. So we won't save $2,500 a family. We can't keep our doctor or our coverage, and you had to lie to get the whole thing passed. And why? Why did they do all this? Because they're stupid. Because Americans are stupid. Now that's the 30 second. The 60 second would be an expanded one of that, incorporating Obama's quotes.
And then the closing card is, this is your Democrat Party. Because we have to hammer home that these jerks are the Democrats.
Yes, using Peter's analogy, look, the other team just fumbled the ball on their own 1 yard line. Take it again. You're going to sit back and hope that the media covers it? Take it. What on earth is he going to be able to advance? Immigration reform? You realize if we get this out there big, the country would hate him so much that if he tries to advance anything.
I just want to underline that one guy sifting through all of the Gruber speeches found this and got it into public view to where we know it's there. And now it's up to us to make wider use of it and push that into, the establishment, the RNC, or whatever, because one guy sat down and got fed up and said, I'm going to do something about it. Don't let anybody tell you you can't make a difference.
And wasn't there opposition from the university about, no, you can't
have it? They took it down.
Yeah.
They took it down. Now, of course, somebody had already, protected it somewhere else, but they got heat for it, too. And they had to put it back up.
Question. If it took you a couple of weeks to put a video together on this, would you have missed your window of opportunity on it?
No.
Okay.
No, I think this has a lifespan, particularly since we're entering into holiday time frame.
And where, there's another case coming.
Right. And that happens in March. The Supreme Court is going to review I guess they take it up in March and they won't rule on it until the end of summer or whatever. I think a couple of weeks is no problem, because this video got an awful lot of interest over the last few days. I mean, all of us, our shares of that video have gotten tons of pluses and reshares, and people are watching that because it's 30 seconds of, you're kidding me, this guy is really saying this in a crowd, in front of people, and he's not ashamed to say it. He's bragging about it because this is a selling point. And then, of course, you see what was really fun and super predictable was our seminar commenters coming in and saying, oh, well, Gruber really didn't have anything to do with Obamacare. He isn't, I know you conservative faux news fans call him the Obamacare architect, but he really had nothing to do with it. He's just one little obscure guy in one little obscure meeting. It's no big deal.
Never mind.
Soros paid you to say that, right?
Never mind. Then why did he keep saying the word we? We couldn't do this. We couldn't do that. We couldn't do this. We couldn't do that. I mean, really, I'd ask him, do you always say we with things that you're not involved in? Come on. We had to sell it this way. We had to do it that way. Come on.
Another thing is, I think that we really should, we talked about the involvement from FreedomWorks and all those people in the election. Isn't this like GenOps milieu, right? This is their area, this is their sweet spot. So, I'm sure we'll see something there, because
Carnival of Obamacare on the Mall, isn't that supposed to happen?
I believe so. So I can't wait to hear about how stupid we are as a country. The great and stupid and that's another thing, is that this is so condescending on so many levels, particularly when you think about who brought Obama into office. Who do they claim, who do they point to? Who was the trigger for Obama getting into office? It was because of the young people. It was because of the millennials. It's our fault. We were the ones. So by virtue of that fact, who's the idiot that he's talking about? Who's the stupid person that he's talking about? Who are the stupid people? So you're telling me that me trusting you, the millennials trusting you, we're stupid?
If you had known that Obamacare was all about you paying more, you healthy people, you young, healthy millennials who voted for Obama, spending more so that older, sick people could get some of your money, if you had known that, you would have never supported Obama and his Obamacare. No, so we had to lie to you.
We heard that 26, that we didn't have to pay for insurance until we were 26. That's what we heard. We didn't hear anything about.
And your parents will save $2,500 a year, so that'll be cool. And you'll keep your same doctor. And what's really awesome is that the needy people who have needed insurance will get it. And millennials are actually legitimately caring, sympathetic, kind people who want to do a lot of good. And so it's easy as pie to sell you on something that you think will be good for will be good for poor people. And Obamacare, and what we all see in the arguments on behalf of Obamacare, sure, it's costing you a lot more money and everyone at your work, and hundreds of thousands of people have lost their insurance, but there are some poor people who have got coverage now, and that makes it all worthwhile. That's the argument that you hear. And people are sincere about that, because what's real to them is needy people getting insurance and getting coverage who couldn't have it before. And what they don't understand is that prior to Obamacare, anyone could walk into any hospital and get medical care and not have to pay anything. But they don't understand that.
Yeah. And as I said, I mean, it's not a good look for the liberals, for the left, to have this guy out there saying that the people who voted the Democrats in are idiots because of this. Having that happen, it is unfathomable that this guy was that cocky and that condescending and that much of a jerk to go and do that. I mean, my age group, the millennials should be really, really annoyed about this, really pissed off about this. And it's on us, it's on our side to, make sure that everyone is well aware of that. And we've seen some good ads from GenOp. I hope that we see some more featuring this soundbite a lot. Also, another thing that millennials don't like is his superior attitude that he was displaying, and is also being displayed in the group chat. Thanks a lot there, Alex P. Keaton. What are you trying to say about my generation? Get off of my lawn, please.
No, what Felicia was trying to say is that while I was saying how millennials are all caring about poor people, Felicia was saying that Gen Xers, like she and I, are Alex P. Keaton's. We don't care about poor people. We're yuppie.
It was a compliment to the millennials.
It was
sure.
An insult.
And you just threw it back in my face. I don't even.
Sure.
I don't even. Do not even.
For sure, it was a compliment. I'm wise to what's going on over there in the chat. terrible.
I'm not gonna mess with you. I just don't care.
What did I ever do to you, Brass?
Point proved.
So when I watched the footage the first time of this Gruber fellow and, his astounding comments, the thing that I latched onto more than the stupid comment was talking about how he counted on Americans in this opaque atmosphere. I mean, I think that was the part that I understood the most was that they're counting on us not necessarily to be stupid, but to be disconnected. That they are counting on us to be looking at our iPods and to be looking at our iPads and whatever other little gizmo it is that we have and not be paying attention to what it is that they're doing. That was the thing. I mean, and they're counting on that. And that's not something that I needed to hear Mr. Gruber say. I was already aware of that. I knew that that was one of the things that they were counting on in order to pass this horrible law. And to have him come out and say it, it felt, I'm not going to say it felt good. I mean, and it doesn't sound good for him to say that Americans are stupid, but I think he was more admitting that they're counting on people not to pay attention to what it is that they're doing. And I think that that could make another really good ad.
Well, and that's also, again, great argument for smaller government. People can't keep up, so they check out.
I just felt great that he revealed himself. I got a high off that, and I'm not coming down off that for a while.
But don't you think it was self-congratulatory?
Yeah.
Isn't that the way it was presented? Is,
oh, yeah, it was very...
Off. And look how we had to do it. And, man, this was the only way you were going to get this great thing because we figured out how to screw you on it.
But isn't this the greatest part of fighting liberals? When they are so arrogant, smug, and self-congratulatory, then they get revealed, and now they're sheepish. He's sheepish and apologetic, and he realizes he has, if the other side doesn't fumble this ball at the one-yard line, he has destroyed pretty much the last remnants of his party for the next few years. I mean, this is huge, guys. This is their signature achievement. This is all they got.
Right, this is what they've been, the universal health care, because Obamacare is the inexorable step towards universal single-payer health care. That's been the goal of progressives since the turn of the century. And what's really kind of cool and fun is that Gruber is also the guy he's the one that we have saying the whole reason we're not going to provide anybody using the federal exchange is because we want to force the states to have their own exchanges. And that's the crux of the matter that the Supreme Court is going to be looking at in March. So not only do we have Gruber being the architect of Obamacare, who is kind of killing the Democrat lie of transparency, he's the guy who's sort of proving the case that's maybe going to kill Obamacare in the courts. So love you, Gruber. I think it's just awesome. Because we've heard about Gruber before, and where we heard of him was he's the one, as the architect of Obamacare, we've got him on record speaking about the legislation that says you get a subsidy from a state exchange, but you don't get a subsidy from the federal exchange. And that's the crux of the matter that is in the court case in March, and if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the plain language of the law, the original stated intent of the law, so, why would they rule in favor of the way the law is written and what it was intended to do? I, don't know why, that'd be crazy, but if they do that, then that pretty much kills Obamacare dead, like a bug, which would be awesome.
I got a quick question. This guy's name is really Gruber.
Yeah. Peter Gruber.
All I can hear in my head is Hans Gruber from Die Hard.
Yep.
What I think we should be doing with ads is you can have so much fun with that. Have somebody turn out to be the worst date a girl ever had. And he should just, like, it's almost like he takes... has a liar curse put on him, and he tells her the truth. I would have told you all this about me up front, but you wouldn't have gone out with me. I would have, and there are so many ways you can spin that. I told you about this, but you wouldn't have bought the car. I would have told you about this, but the ads we could do on this are wonderful. I wish somebody would do it.
That's always the worst part of these discussions. This would make a great ad. I wish somebody would be able to do it. But hopefully, I do think that GenOp will work on this because it's just too obvious and too big a deal to ignore. And it's no wonder that there are so many distractions that the left is trying to throw at us to get away from this issue. But again, I can't wait until the court case, because that's when we'll see these ads. That's when we'll see some serious business happening, because people are going to be very, very outraged if this law stands through all of this. So can't wait until March.
Okay, nobody wants to read that out loud.
I'll read that because it's so patently untrue. It's annoying.
Yeah.
From Red State, of course, it would be from Red State because, yeah. Republican majority, day one, McConnell surrenders. Really? It's just...
Let me guess, Eric Erickson, did he write that one?
No, it wasn't.
There was actually a decent article on Red State not too long ago, but it wasn't written by Eric, of course.
No, this is by Leon Wolf, but it's absolutely ridiculous. What is the point of this article? What are we doing here with this? What does this accomplish?
I believe it works towards Obama's goals of splitting the GOP. Oh, wait, red states not supposed to be doing that, are they?
Okay, first off, we aren't in the 2015 legislative session yet. The new Congress, the new Senate is not in place yet. Talking is one thing. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff to happen. How do you declare McConnell, just like it's unreasonable.
Preemptive capitulation? Good Lord.
I don't get it. I don't understand what the point of this is. What are they trying to achieve?
Blog hits.
Of course. And as a capitalist, I hope they do very well with their blog hits. As a conservative, I hope that they do miserably, because what are you trying to do? Break up our team already? I mean...
Actually, if you're a true capitalist, you'll hope that they won't get any hits, to be honest with you, because you want the market to succeed and you would like their ideas to fail in the free market.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
Just saying.
Well played. Well played, Brass. Well played. But, yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous to go out and just, oh, well, we aren't there yet. There hasn't been any discussion. There hasn't been any debate. Nothing's happened. And he isn't even the majority leader yet. He's proposed to be the... Everybody thinks that he's going to be the majority leader. I think he's going to be the majority leader. But it doesn't matter, because this headline is entirely clickbait. Nothing is going to... What on earth are you trying to accomplish? I need to read this. I need to read this. Fishy, if you've actually been looking at it, I would love it if you could tell us a little bit more, because I need to read a little bit of this before I go on, because I need to know what possibly it could be that Mitch McConnell said that somehow, oh God, everything that we accomplished on Tuesday, it's over, guys, it's over. That's basically what they're saying here, is it's done.
Darma Gerd, we elected him a week ago, and Obama hasn't been impeached yet. What the heck, man? I'm never going to be a Republican again.
How are we so slow on that?
I clicked over on it and read it, which I'm kind of disappointed that I did now that I said what I said, but because I just gave him traffic. I'm like, damn it, I fell for it. But that said, we did want to know what he was saying. And the gist of it is that he's saying that McConnell is capitulating because he is not using his most potent weapons. In other words, he's saying we're not going to use those weapons. And those weapons are government shutdown, and I forget the other one. And I'm thinking to myself, you're a terrible strategist, because you don't walk into a fight using your biggest bombs or your most potent weapons. You save them for the right moment and the right time, preferably never having to use them at all. I mean, that's the idea, is that I have these weapons, but I would prefer not to use them. It's the idea behind a nuclear war, is that you don't have it because I could use it. I have the potential. I would prefer not to. And people want to sit down and negotiate with you, which is exactly what you want. You don't run in and say, we're going to use this. You say, we're not putting it on the table right away. We would like to talk. But if you're not going to, then maybe we will. And he's saying, because McConnell said, no, that's not on the table, that it's capitulation. I think what McConnell's saying is, sorry, we're not going to threaten government shutdown right away because it sounds obstructionist.
Of course. So is that what we're trying to? Is that our goal? Is our goal to make ourselves look like obstructionists? Is that what we're trying to achieve?
Well, my only concern is that I wish he would say it more like Peter. We're not either say you're not doing it right away or don't mention it. It's like Obama in the Middle East. Don't tell people we're not going to do ground troops. We're going to leave at this time. We're going to – don't tell everybody what you're going to do or not going to do. Let them guess.
Okay, but that brings this up. Did – and the article's making an argument that we did not. Did the Republicans pay a price for shutting down the government a year ago? The answer to that is complex. I don't know that it's a yes or no. I think we dodged a bullet. Honestly, I think that we had a conflux of other events that got in the way of that being the story.
I was going to say, we paid for it last year as it was happening, for sure. Absolutely, for sure.
Right, and then when we go forward on this, the fact that we can, that they're stating as fact that the GOP didn't pay a price for it, they mean that a year later it did not rebound to them and hit them in the face because the Democrats didn't hit on it. But if the people are saying that they're against Obama's policies, but that they want Washington to work, which is one interpretation of the election results, that they want Washington to work and that they don't think the crew that was there is doing things and they want things done now, which, God, scares me, but okay, we'll get into that another time. But if that's what the people are saying, the general public impression of the Republicans shutting the government down because, which they, really we can blame Obama for that, but because they don't own the broadcasts, they don't own the megaphones to combat that narrative, it is a dicey game. And if you are coming in on your first day of being the speaker-elect, as it were, even if you haven't had your election yet, but you're assumed to be the majority leader, if you're assumed to be coming back to leadership and taking Harry Reid's job, do you want that narrative to go out to the country that you're going to now shut the government down because Obama won't come to the table when you're not even sitting in the majority leader chair yet?
Well, and not only that, but look at the dirty tricks they pulled. Okay, they shut down the World War II monument and turned away World War II vets from their own monument. It's an open-air monument that's open 24/7. Okay, that was ridiculous. How about Mount Rushmore? There's a place along the highway where you can actually pull off along the side of the road and take pictures. Oh, well, we can't have that, so they put cones up. Okay, so how do you explain that to your kids when you're on vacation, your family vacation, and they're all excited to go see something, or a national park or a monument or something like that? And then all of a sudden, oh, well, you can't do that. Well, why not, Mommy? Well, because the Republicans shut down the government.
And we couldn't capitalize on it because, as you say, Fishy, the other side owns the media, academia, and entertainment. I'm going to do something right now that nobody on the right has done for several years, and I wish they would do. And if they would do, we could turn everything around and win. I'm going to admit I was wrong. Okay? I supported Ted Cruz and the defund Obamacare agenda. I supported it 100%. And I still think, by the way, it wasn't totally wrong. I think it sent a great message to the American people. At least our side is dedicated to really removing this thing that you hate. Okay? But the polls showed people didn't want a shutdown. They were against a shutdown for that, okay? Now, they're wrong. People, A shutdown's a great thing, okay? But the polls showed that would be catastrophic. The people who said, no, 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 fight for delay, not defund, the people I disagreed with, were right. All of their predictions came true. All of their predictions of what would happen with the polls and how it would affect us and how that would empower this corrupt president and his party were true. All of them were true. That doesn't make me any less a supporter of Ted Cruz. I still think his messaging and where he is dead right and fantastic for the party. But we're not perfect. And we on our side never admit we're wrong anymore. Nobody does. Well, I'm doing it right now. I'm leading the way. Can somebody else in the conservative universe somewhere admit they were wrong?
I'm actually going to jump in and say I supported Ted Cruz, and I'm not entirely sure I'm ready to say that I'm wrong. However, I'm going to counter what you're saying by coming back to what I said about going on the offensive. The reason that we supported Ted Cruz, and I could be wrong, I don't want to speak for you, Andy. The reason I supported him, and I really feel like a lot of other conservatives supported what Ted Cruz did, was not necessarily because they wanted a government shutdown. What they wanted was somebody in Republican leadership to stand up and fight for them. And the only person that actually had the balls to do so was Ted Cruz. Everybody else caved. And you have the majority of Republicans embarrassed by Republican leadership, specifically John Boehner. I'm embarrassed by him.
No. I totally agree with that.
So when you look at what he did and you say, well, we dodged a bullet, I wonder how much he actually motivated the base. I think it's a legitimate question. And if I'm wrong, I'm willing to admit I'm wrong.
Well, no. I am totally agreeing that what Boehner did was terrible. There's absolutely no defense of that. And I loved how Cruz stood up. I loved how Cruz spoke the truth. My only thing was this. There were people on the delay side versus defund who said, we love everything about it, but we don't like the strategy. It's counterproductive. And that's all I'm saying. Their strategy, they were right on the strategy. He was right on the heart. He was right on the proclamation. He was right on being strong. And Boehner was totally wrong on cutting the legs out from under him. Actually, John McCain did a much worse job of it. But
And that's where I was saying, I think we hurt our own side, and that's where the left was successful at getting us to divide against ourselves. Had we been a bit more unified in supporting Cruz with the defund Obamacare, knowing that we were in negotiations, we were asking for the moon, which was defunding Obamacare, and we knew that wasn't going to happen, and we would settle for a delay. But if you ask for a delay, you get nothing. So you ask for defund, rally your troops behind it, convince, show the other side how powerful of a force you have behind your defund Obamacare movement, and that's going to force them to the negotiating table. But because our side wasn't unified enough at that time, there was a tactical error, or the result ended up being an error because we had so many people on the right who were gleefully celebrating the failure of Ted Cruz.
Yeah, but let's keep in mind, tons of the people in the delay crowd, there were only a couple who came out and made those idiotic statements undermining Ted Cruz. The vast majority of the people on Capitol Hill in the delay crowd said nothing and were not nasty. And at the very worst, they said, well, I just don't think it's the soundest strategy. And the people I also disagree, though, on Cruz's side, and by the way, Cruz didn't do this, but there were people on his side who just attacked anyone who didn't take the defund stance and just attacked them. They're rhinos. They're terrible. They're Democrats. They're Democrat light. They're ruining us. They're destroying us and all this. And all these people were saying is, guys, it's not sound strategy. And folks, they were right.
And I wonder how much of that argument we had to have a year ago so that we could get what we got this year.
I think, too, that this going forward is a lesson for us in looking at setting our expectations. While I agree, Leslie, with your assumption that if you ask for defund and you get delay, that that's probably the more effective, negotiation strategy,
mm-hmm.
we have to not tell people that delay is a defeat. When compared to defund in a negotiation. And too often what we get are people like Cruz who have thought through those issues strategically and knows that if you push for defund, you might get delay. But then the people that are following that and sort of half paying attention aren't thinking strategically about a pickup of any sort being a victory.
Mm-hmm.
They're insisting on defund or nothing, and that's where you get those nasty comments back to the delay people, or you get nasty comments to people looking, back at those defund people saying, they're extremists or whatever, they're not being realistic. And we do need to keep realism in mind here about what we can reasonably expect to achieve. I think that's really big for me. I've made a list of some things. Maybe that we should start concentrating on as a decision matrix. Whenever there's a bill under consideration, can it be passed? That would be the first thing that I would ask. Can it be passed in both houses? If it can it be signed? If it can't be signed, then what is the purpose of doing it? Is it a statement to the public? Is it to be shown to be doing something? Is it something that's going to position us properly for 2016? And if it's not something that positions us properly for 2016, I'm suspicious of it. It's suspect to me. And then does it help move the culture in the right way, moving our argument toward the culture? That's usually the last place you'd go to look for cultural support, but that is something that we have to look at. Does it move the conversation? And then talking about how we stay out of our own way going toward 2016, if we look through that series of questions, I think we could avoid some of the problems that we had around the divisiveness, like on the shutdown, because we're constantly thinking about, does this get us into a better position overall for 2016? Does this help move an issue for us, or is it just temper to lash out or to, stick Obama's nose in something? If I'm going to rub his nose in something, I want half of the country plus a whole bunch more people behind me when I do it.
I will say that I was go ahead.
One of the tactics that the left uses, and they've used it for decades, is when they want to advance a position, what they will do is they will take a more extreme position, knowing they'll get something more moderate passed. And now that the right is aware of that, elements of the right are aware of that, and you get where we have. It's like you push for defund and you get delay, which is it's a tactic and it works. It doesn't get you your ultimate goal, but it inches you closer. So where do you draw the line with a decision matrix like that? You push hard in one direction and you don't get that, but you inch things forward. So where's the line on that?
I don't know. And honestly, I think setting expectations is really important. And when you have Ted Cruz out there setting expectations for people who are not paying attention to the broader picture, then it could be a problem. And if you have McConnell setting lower expectations that he intends to overachieve and people don't recognize that, then that's a different kind of problem. I just want people to stop reacting viscerally and emotionally to what they think is going on without taking a step back and asking some of those questions. We're going to get it right in some places and wrong in others, but at least if we're not just knee-jerk reacting because of who says something or spinning the words to say what we think they mean, and give them time to work out strategy and play through those things, I think it works out better for us, even if we lose on a lot of negotiations.
I agree with you. I think that one of the things that is that it comes back to what we had said earlier, which is that we haven't been on the offensive for so long, people are frustrated by it. So when they don't see the ball move at all, except in the opposite direction, the reaction is to push for any movement in any direction. And unfortunately, what you have, and it's football season, so we're going to run with the football analogies. You basically have people on the right. Yes, sports team is involved. Fishy is going to make those faces at least for the next 3 months. and then we'll get into baseball. You have people on the right that rather than having a strategy of, okay, let's do a short and out pass and we advance the ball 3, 4, 6, 8 yards, or we're going to do a run play that, you know, gets us a few yards, every single play their call is for the long bomb in the end zone. Well, you can't win games when every single play is a long bomb in the end zone. It just doesn't work. Conversely, I think that you're right, in which people just keep having these reactions rather than a response. A reaction is where you respond at an emotional, visceral level. A response is thought out. It is logical. It is conditioned. It's something that you know how to deal with, and that we are letting ourselves be controlled emotionally rather than setting our emotions aside and thinking through what we do. And so we need to stop reacting and start responding.
Absolutely.
Except for sports.
And to continue. No, but to continue with the sports thing analogy, in this case, when we threw the long ball, it got intercepted, and it's still being, you know, used against us. And I can speak from where I am here in New Jersey that it was brought up. Cory Booker, of course, he used the Tea Party and their shutdown. Of course, I mean that's something that they're using. That's a long term effect of this. And even the question that was sent to McConnell, the question that was asked of McConnell, are you going to shut down the government? Why on earth would they have that in their repertoire? Why is that a question? The reason it's a question is because it actually happened.
And look at the contrast it draws, the way that he said what he said, between Harry Reid, who was willing to let that happen, because they knew they could pin it on the Republicans, to Mitch McConnell, who comes in ready to work and ready to stay at the table over and over again. How does that contrast play? And people in the middle are the ones who you're playing to with that sort of thing. Not the base, not the folks who are already on your team, and certainly not to the opposition who's going to fight you no matter what. You're playing to the middle. You want to be seen as different, as working together, as putting forth ideas. You want to be seen as getting back to work so that you can respond to the people that way. If they're going to say the government is full of, you know, shut down, do nothing Republicans who want to hurt people and make sure their checks don't come and shut down the government and whatever, You got to fight that narrative. This is a way to do it.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, maybe was it the best way to state it? I don't know. But I can definitely say that if it happens where we do need to dip into the nuclear option, then we get to pull out the great old, well, you forced us. I mean, you forced our hand. Our hand is forced. What are we supposed to do? You won't sign this stuff. So you know what? If you won't sign this bill, we've been trying to cooperate with you all year. We've put a bunch of bills up to your desk. We've tried it. You've shut down the government. So you know what? We're just going to do what you did. You know, that's the way that you approach this, making it so that it's their fault. Making it so that, you know what? You forced our hand. That's it. We haven't been able to pass this legislation. So you know what? It's on you.
And
since we don't have the media, we don't have education, we don't have entertainment, it will never be anyone's fault other than ours. And that's why you have Mitch McConnell saying from the get-go, no, we're not going to shut down the government. We're not going to default on the debt, because he wants to calm the masses and, you know, leave an open space there that he is a reasonable negotiator. And later, if he is forced to shut down the government or default on the debt because of the other side, he will try to blame the other guys. But you realize that it'll be McConnell's fault for not negotiating, because understand that to Obama, and if it's Obama's perspective, it's the media's perspective, and it is the conventional wisdom, negotiation means agreeing with him.
But see, that's the difference. If we can show that we've been in good faith trying to pass bills, and that's what we've been doing, excuse me.
We've been doing it forever.
No, but those bills didn't make it to his desk. They didn't make it to his desk. Harry Reid shut those things down. It was a situation where none of our stuff got to his desk. We didn't have Obama come out and reject these bills, veto them. That's not what happened. Sorry, Fishy, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to underline what you're saying, because that was the quote that we talked about last week, that the president hadn't been sent anything he didn't like to be signed, because Harry Reid wouldn't allow that. Now he's going to get things on his desk to sign or not sign. And that's an action that does or doesn't happen, that has to happen in the Oval Office. And Mitch McConnell's response to that is, we have sent him. Now that we're Republicans are in the charge of the Senate, we have sent him bill after bill. We have sent him option after option. He refuses to look at any of them. That's a message you might be able to work better.
Exactly. And then when something that is a, you know, piece of legislation gets vetoed, and probably, you know, several pieces of legislation will be vetoed. If I'm the president, I think that I'm going to be vetoing a lot of things, just because ideologically that's where I am. I don't know how skilled he's going to be on this in the handling of this, whether he's going to moderate as the years go on. I don't know. But if he vetoes a bill, and as Fishy said, that's an action, the American people will be aware of it. And it's not just something that the media can plaster over. It's not something that you can just easily, wipe it away. We've done something. We put these bills on your table, and if they aren't signed, it's on you. Go through that process, and if we have to come to the standstill where we've gotten nothing through past Obama because he doesn't want to do it, and we don't have a veto, we aren't going to have a veto-proof majority. We don't have that right now. So if we get to that point where he's doing absolutely nothing and nothing is getting done and he's being the obstructionist and we can paint him as the obstructionist, then we can absolutely go and say, all right, if you want to be an obstructionist, we'll play ball. We're going to be the obstructionist. We're going to go into a government shutdown because you've shut down the government. You did.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that we're going to play ball. I wouldn't even phrase it with us having
right,
our hands
obviously.
On
I'm
it
sorry.
At all. But that is a good point, is that Republicans now, one of the first things they should be doing behind closed doors, and the piece we talked about at the beginning of the show makes me think this is happening, more likely happening, is talk about the answers to that. They should be wargaming. There should be a war room in the Senate, in the Republican side, where they are gaming nonstop all of the answers, all of the kind of things that are going to come up, and what their response should be, so that everybody's on the same page. That's what I hope comes out, based on what I've seen for how we got them into office.
Because, you know, when the Senate starts passing, the House has been passing bills that Obama would never sign, and when the Senate starts doing the same thing, and, you know, and those bills that the House passed, the Senate never took up, and we tried to push back against that and blame it on Harry Reid's obstructionism, but that was turned back on us and has been turned back on us for the last 6 years, because the House is doing things they know aren't going to be open, that the Senate isn't going to vote on, so the House is wasting the government, wasting the nation's money and being frivolous and not being cooperative and all of these things. So it's the House that gets the blame for it. And now it's going to be the House and the Senate that get the blame for doing things that they know full well Obama's going to veto. And our only hope is that, yes, the GOP is in there wargaming these arguments, because those are the arguments that they're going to have. That's what's going to happen. We're going to be told that by Soros and all of his minions in the media and everywhere else, that it's the House and the Senate, those obstructionist, unrealistic, I don't know, hardcore. I mean, there's only a hardcore Republican. There's never any kind of a reasonable Republican or moderate Republican. Everybody's a hardcore rightist or whatever we are. It's going to be their fault that they don't give Obama anything he can sign, because he will give the sad speeches, because he wants so much to take care of us, and he wants to do the right thing. And if the Senate and the House would just get together and send him something that he can sign, he really would love to, because he cares. You know that's going to happen. And I really hope the GOP is gaming that out.
If you're sending a ton of legislation to his desk over and over and over again, pardon me, and he keeps vetoing it, then he can't fall back on that anymore, because it's, we are sending you stuff. In fact, we're sending you good stuff that you, you know, that Democrats are voting on and approval of this, and you're not working with us. Suddenly, all of his stuff that he works to say backfires on him because of the amount of legislation that sits on his desk.
But he's supporting the two-thirds of America that didn't vote.
Yeah, what time are you going to pick up the ball and start running down the field, Leslie? Okay, run.
And see, that's exactly right. He's going to be forced into a situation where he has to sign bills, or he's, you know, the left are going to suffer more losses. And there's going to be a point in time where people in the Senate, the leftists, the Democrats in the Senate and the House, they're going to be sweating, because legislation that they need to get reelected, stuff that is important to their constituents, is going to be vetoed, because that's just how we're going to make it. And when those things get vetoed, their chances of being reelected, they go down, they dwindle.
Yeah.
And you know, these people are going to get desperate, and when that desperation happens, they have one person to blame. And if you don't think that there's the Democrats in the House and Senate are going to pressure Obama to sign legislation, you're wrong. They will.
Because Obama doesn't care. He doesn't have to win election anymore. But there are a lot of Democrats in the Senate and the House that do. So that's our hope, really.
And if they start calling him out, if they start doing that, because they get forced into this untenable situation, they're not going to get reelected if these things don't pass. I mean, this is the definition of a no-win scenario for them. That's what we want to get. That's where we want them to be. We want them to be stuffed into a place where they can't get out of it. Either we get our legislation passed the way that we want it, or they don't get reelected. Then we pass our legislation in 2017 when we have a Republican president. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
The expectations that people should be setting about this is that Obama will not sign anything, and that he will do exactly what Leslie has said and tried to frame it that way. And every Republican needs to be schooled in the art of selling a bill with a personal story, just the way that Democrats have perfected for years and years, and with appeals to broad common sense, so that most people would look at the legislation and say, how could he not sign this? That is the strategy, I think, for everything that the Senate and the House want to do. It should be framed with stories, it should be framed with a common sense appeal, and it should touch on so much the American people in general that are not paying attention, that they'll be completely befuddled as to why the president wouldn't sign something. That's your positioning.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, exactly. Our guys have to stay on message and not make any stupid mistakes. They're not allowed to, because they have an R behind their names. Yes, that's so very true. Yeah. Our guys have to be better, and they have to be getting practice at and preparing for these arguments and making the broad appeals to common sense, like you said. And we, as their cheerleaders, you know, much as I don't want to spend the next couple of years cheerleading for the Republicans, because we all have our arguments against them, but really we need to back their play. It's human nature to want to do favors for the people who support you, not the people who yell at you. You know, I'm going to be more likely to be friendly to somebody who's friendly to me than to, I don't know, somebody who's red-stating me. You know, if you're McConnell, are you going to want to, and Eric Erickson calls you up and asks you a favor, are you going to be inclined to say, oh, yeah, would love to, because I know that, you know, you're on my side? No, Eric Erickson doesn't appear to be on McConnell's side in any way, shape, or form, so McConnell's not going to be inclined to cooperate with him. And I think we need to be more of the people that Republicans want to cooperate with us, so we can make, we've put them in office, and we can make demands on them now, because they're in office thanks to us, and we supported them. They can support us and our views, and we need to be understanding and supportive and be on their team, wanting to help them get better and be better players on our team. You know, there are ways to help your teammates get better when your teammates mess up without accusing them of being on the other team.
Nobody likes a Brandon Marshall. Nobody likes the guy who's, like, calling out everybody but themselves on their team. Nobody likes that guy. It's just,
I have no idea what you just said.
He's a wide receiver for the Bears and a well-known, you know, prima donna jerk who never takes any of the blame for himself. So nobody likes that guy.
You know, one thing I really like about what Fish is saying, and you're right, JD, nobody likes that guy, and it's alienating, is that she's saying, look to the future. You know, with both the establishment and with Democrats, we need to start getting a little bit of perspective and looking to the future. And here's what I mean. With the establishment, we have to understand the Republican Party is going through a very, very, by historical terms, a very rapid transformation into being a Tea Party libertarian hybrid. Every poll shows it. That's where the Republican Party is going. Okay? Let's stop freaking out in the meantime when those who have been in power for the last few decades lash out in the middle of that. They're going to. It's okay, because I'm thinking about all their supporters who I don't want to alienate in the process. The party is going Tea Party Libertarian Hybrid. That's what it's becoming. I personally like that. Another person may not. Well, then you're free to influence that. That's okay. But We need to start thinking ahead and forward and not blowing up in the here and now and letting everything in the here and now blow us up because we don't see with vision about why they're reacting like that. And the other thing is this. You know, we're talking a lot about 2016, and we should, because let me tell you something, folks. The Democrats are desperate for 2016 because they know what's coming in 2018. They have to take back, they can't just get the presidency, they have to take back the Senate in 2016, and I don't think they will, but they have to, because 2018, they're going to get clobbered. The vast majority of seats coming open in 2018 are theirs, all right? So this next 2 years, you have a very, very desperate party on the other side of the aisle. Desperate parties do desperate things. Be ready for it.
I think that's
is it wrong that it kind of excites me?
No, because what desperate parties do when they do that, when they get into that desperation mode, is they make mistakes too. So it's about capitalizing on those mistakes and, you know, taking the ball and running with it, as we've been saying this entire night. So we have a really good shot here. It's not time to call McConnell a weak, you know, leader or majority leader. It's not the right time to do that. We've got a lot of years now to work on that. Right now, the time is to figure out the best way to directly quote Joni Ernst, make them squeal. This is the time. This is what we have to focus on now.
I have one last comment, and it's really more of a it's a comment question, and that is we've talked about you know, some of the things that we could do. We sat there and sort of brainstormed a Gruber video, my question really becomes, how do we get some of the messaging that we would like to see put out there to the GOP such that they start to put it out there? A secondary follow-up question would be, how do we get the GOP to start fighting, going on the offense, and in places that actually work, as opposed to, say, Ted Cruz doing a government shutdown? Yeah, I understand his strategy. I understand the way that it works, but most don't. So how do we reach the GOP from where we're at such that they start to do the proper messaging, such that they start to do the proper fighting? I think that those are legitimate questions, and I don't think that we answer them tonight. I want to put that out there because I think that that is one of those things that we need to start discussing, is how do we translate what we talk about here such that it reaches the GOP that's in charge of messaging?
Two things. Number one, lead by example, and that's what we're talking about in building a video. Number two, you got a Twitter. They got a Twitter account. Everybody now in leadership on the GOP side, you can tweet them, you can send them direct messages, and you can blog about it. The three things. You can blog about it, too. Don't think they don't read advice, and if we are actually sharing pieces well enough to get them a little bit of attention, they will actually get that in front of them. It's entirely possible. This is the democratization of politics with Twitter out there. They can't ignore that stuff. They can pretend they didn't see it, but you're going to get through it. You're going to reach them. And if it's multiple times retweeted, that's something important that they will pay attention to. So building, leading by example, sending them tweets, and blogging about it. I mean, that's immediately what anybody could do. And those things work. Remember the guy who found the Gruber stuff? One guy. One guy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to reiterate. Thank you for going there, was the fact that, hey, if that one guy, if Gruber could do it, then what's our excuse? We can totally do this. We can get, I mean, if you look at a lot of the senators on Twitter, they do have conversations with people. I mean, that's not something that never occurs. It's not like there aren't many ways to communicate with senators, particularly if they're your senator. I mean, calling their office, I know that might sound a little bit arcane and, you know, outdated, but that works too sometimes. It's unlike in my case, my senators both have their email, or their answering machines are both full. Like, they're both full constantly. I don't know why that is, that they don't work on that, but I can totally get in touch with my congressperson. My congressperson always has an empty voice message box. I can talk to him about this stuff. There are ways to communicate these ideas and ask for this stuff to get done. But also, we did spend a good deal of time talking tonight about how the GOP seems to be getting their act together and realizing that they need to act, not just act out of, you know, random impulse, but to act with strategy, act with, you know, with an idea of what they want to accomplish. So hopefully some combination of us pushing them and them realizing, oh, hey, we should probably do this stuff, hopefully we'll get done, or, you know, get to the point where we have a president in 2016 that's a Republican, we have a Congress, a Senate, and we can actually work on making the country freer and getting a better business climate and, you know, doing the stuff that we want to accomplish.
And I think it's all about keeping it positive rather than negative. You know, encourage the GOP to do more of the good stuff. Encourage your friends on the things that you agree with them on. And when they start talking about net neutrality, change the subject to Keystone XL pipeline. Because yeah, net neutrality doesn't matter, but Keystone XL does. And that's one of those things that actually could get passed before next year. That could actually get passed during the lame duck, which is amazing. And that would be a huge turnaround, because that would be the Democrats defying Obama during the lame duck. That would be kind of awesome and would be really fun to do. But yeah, you know, everybody was talking about net neutrality today, but if we just decide, you know what, I'm not even going to talk about that tomorrow because it's irrelevant and stupid, and Barack Obama doesn't set the agenda anymore. And we're going to talk about the things that I want to talk about, which would be cool, and to don't red state anybody. And I vote for turning red state into a verb, meaning to insult the people on your own side. Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe I don't want to slam red state that much, give them an opportunity.
Aren't you red stating red state for red stating Mitch McConnell? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God, I just fell into a meta black hole or something. I don't know.
Red stateception.
Yes.
Okay, so I should probably, okay, red state is not a verb. I will celebrate that website when they do good things, and every now and then they have bad articles. Right? Gang, I think we're through with another episode for this week.
An epic-sode.
An epic-sode.
22 in the books.
And everybody remember, we need to all be really terrified of, you know, Mary Landrieu, because... because no reason.
Wendy Davis's manager is now working for her.
Yeah.
Terror.
Battleground Louisiana. Terror. Next, we're going to see Mary in some little pink tennis shoes. That'll be awesome. Wading across a bayou or something. I don't know.
Have you seen Mary Landrieu? It won't be little.
Oh, that's me. That's me.
Back into the... Oh, my goodness. Messaging.
Well,
we're a show about messaging. Messaging.
Yeah, we suck. Oh, well. You know,
Mary Landrieu should wear a white sheet and one of those big, like, ZZ Top beards over it to try to appeal to all the, you know, white racists in the South, you know, and women haters and all that. I think she should just go full bore and appeal to what she thinks the South is.
That's true, because how is she going to win an election in Louisiana with the racist women haters that are the voters?
White power!
White power! That's awesome. I mean,
really, and by the way, guys, did that not harken back to the bitter clinger comments of Barack Obama? This is what these people are like, bitterly clinging to God, guns, and
their guns and their religion. Oh, mama.
Oh, my goodness. This is we should have ended the episode like 2 minutes ago.
What happens when a show goes off the rails? Stay tuned.
I take full responsibility for this. You're
welcome. Come back for next week, where we'll start off well and really, really go downhill from there. Okay, so... What I think the message that I'm getting from the rest of you guys is that we should probably stop the broadcast because we've dug ourselves a really deep hole.
No, I can dig harder.
No, I know. Peter, I trust that you can make it worse, Peter. I trust it. You don't have to prove it.
All right. Okay.
Okay, so...
Thank everybody who's listening. Yeah, sorry.
Thank you, everybody, for being here on the chat and live listeners and... everybody who's going to listen and forward all of the clips throughout the week that JD works very hard on, JD and Felicia both. And we will see you guys next week, next Tuesday at 8:30 Central. And that'll conclude your broadcast evening for today. Good night. Happy Veterans Day, everybody.